somebody to another appointment with the B-Vector interviews. So the interview of today is very particular because today we are actually going back in history, and the interview will be about the history of malaria, and we can call it Homo bellicus. So the impact of the Second World War on malaria and mosquito proliferation. And we are talking with our professor, historian, Marcus Hall from the University of Zurich. I'm very pleased to have you here today. It's really a pleasure. And I know you for a long time, and I like very much your lecture. So welcome to B-Vector.
Thank you, Eva. Let's see what we can cover today with our malaria and warfare. We'll see what comes out of this.
Yes, okay. So I read your very interesting paper, and it's really intriguing to see the impact that a war can have on mosquito and mosquito transmitted pathogens, in the case like Plasmodium, which caused malaria disease. And there are basically a few aspects that I would like you to emphasize from your paper. And first of all, it's actually the effect of the war on malaria. Why? Please, the floor is yours.
Okay, well, it's well known that disease is a big problem during warfare. Soldiers catch all sorts of diseases, and mosquito-borne diseases in particular, everything from yellow fever to malaria. And so one of the big challenges for generals directing their soldiers was to control the diseases on the battlefield. And so the question that I posed was, what was this situation in Italy during World War II? Because it's a very malarial place, and of course warfare was cruel and long across the peninsula in the 1940s. And so the question here then was, how did warfare affect the disease of malaria? And then maybe in turn, how did malaria affect warfare? And I looked through the archives and talked to different malariologists and people involved in malaria control. And of course, there's a very long and interesting historical footprint that came out of this.
Yeah, because it's actually, if we think about the Second World War, if we think about all these tanks moving on the soil, on the ground, they are actually kind of modifying the landscape. Isn't it? So
that's exactly what happened when soldiers and tanks and cars would drive through new areas. They'd leave pockmarks where bombs exploded. So the landscape itself became much more watery. Puddles were everywhere. And in fact, I read that in World War II, some soldiers' jobs was to go back over areas where tanks had driven and then fill up those tracks with their shovels to make sure that puddles didn't form. It was well known at the time that even small puddles around houses and in battlefields were terrific mosquito breeding zones. And so this is certainly what happened across the southern peninsula of Italy in 1943.
Yeah.
And so the story here goes that when the Allied soldiers invaded Sicily in 1943 in the summertime, almost as many soldiers died from malaria fevers as they died from shrapnel wounds and gunshot. And so a central problem there for the soldiers from both sides was to avoid these malaria conditions and see if they could combat the enemy in other ways. Let me show you some interesting graphs that I found in the archives. We historians maybe spend too much time looking in archives, but here's some interesting. I'll share my screen with you here.
Yes, please.
This is an often reproduced graph of mortality from malaria in Italy from 1887 to 1950. And you can see that it's dropping here quite precipitously. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Of course, people are combating malaria in all different ways, but during World War I, malaria mortality rises. During World War II, it rises again and pretty much disappears by the 1940s. And so here the obvious conclusion here is warfare exacerbates malaria. All of the problems, the The people, soldiers are living outside, the hospitals are far away, there's the landscape which is conducive to malaria, and so it produces these tracks.
It's actually true, because also the shelter, I mean, the buildings were bombarded, so people were obliged to sleep outdoor, right? So they were more exposed to mosquito bites.
Nighttime sleeping out of doors was a major issue here, and so soldiers would contract malaria, as well as refugees from the East and from Africa. They were coming into Italy following that, and they themselves would be bringing soldiers, or sorry, they would be bringing the malaria contagion with them. And so, yeah, it was a problematic time where not just malaria, of course, but all sorts of other diseases then became more widespread.
You estimated 20, in your paper is written 21,000 soldiers, American and British soldiers, die for diseases related to malaria, for malaria disease, and 17,000 were hospitalized for injuries, right? So many more.
Some of the data that comes out shows actually even more people dying from malaria than from gunshot wounds, at least in the Sicilian campaign there, which lasted
one or
2 months there. So I mean, a very brutal and real condition of warfare was disease, and in this case malaria specifically. So what happens here, the Allies march up the peninsula, they are beating back the German, basically the German forces all the way up to Naples. They get and they take hold of Naples by the winter time, and suddenly they have to confront the issue of typhus epidemics, which are frequently a problem in Naples during the 40s in the winter time, and they are also worried about their own Allied soldiers. And lo and behold, the new wonder insecticide of DDT is available by 1943, which they then use on civilians to control the lice population, which is the vector which transmits the typhus. And so the stories there are that civilians are dusted repeatedly with DDT, experimented pesticide of DDT, and so they're spraying it on people's clothing, in their hair, under their hats, under their armpits, for about a 2 month period there. And so there's lots of here, I think I have a picture here of this period here in Naples. And so this was a common project here for about 2 months in 1943-44, the winter there of this time. Do I have, here we go, another one.
Oh wow.
This appeared in the Saturday Evening Post. And so this is DDT powder right into the face, and this person doesn't seem to be objecting, presumably because they know that if they can kill the lice, then they can get rid of the typhus and be better off in the long run. So I mean, these are the sort of things that happened during warfare. There were very abbreviated safety protocols, and some of the ethical standards were dropped way down because these were emergencies. The enemy was on the horizon, and there were new chemicals being produced here during the war too, because of the quick story with DDT is that
why DDT? I mean,
it's a reaction to the Japanese block of chrysanthemum and pyrethrum, which is a derivative of chrysanthemum, which is largely grown in the Philippines at the time. And so since the Japanese had occupied the Philippines by this time, then the Allies had to suddenly come up with new remedies, new ways, other insecticides to combat mosquitoes and the mosquito-borne diseases. So DDT was one of the offshoots of that whole sort of hyper-experimental period of the time.
Pyrethrum is still in use now, in fact, has adulticides to kill mosquitoes. So it's funny how we look back and some methods are still in use now, or let's say they've been adapted. I mean, we well known them for a long, long time. can still use. So we have these two situations. One is the environmental changes and how this has an impact on the mosquito proliferation and abundance of the vector of the Plasmodium, which causes malaria. And we have also people that are more exposed. So this is again a consequence of the kind of environment change, because all the buildings are destroyed. So this is like now the situation here, and the use of a DDT to in response to this abundance of the vectors, so to kill the vectors. So we have like a kind of you can explain better, because in your paper you talk about also how these environmental changes were now also offering breeding sites, because there were water retained in many places, and this is kind of becoming an open air laboratory, right? Because we had all this field full of water and a lot of mosquitoes. So what did the entomologists
Warfare was an ideal situation to try out new remedies, both insecticides and also anti-malarials, the medicines. And so atabrine itself, which was the traditional drug of choice against malaria, was proving itself less effective by the 1920s and 30s. And so the rush was on to find anti-malarials as well. As the Allies moved northward and the retreating Axis armies also moving northward, they encountered a lot of the coastal regions by Rome, the Pontine Marshes, which formerly were very malarial, but those had been drained meticulously by Mussolini and his efforts, canaled and drained, and there were actually big pumps that had pumped these areas out. And so the Axis saw this as a wonderful opportunity to reflood these areas, not only to create a difficult place to move across, but also a new malarial environment because of the mosquitoes, which would suddenly start to grow ferociously that next summer. Though I think we're in 1944 by this point. And so one sometimes claims that this flooding of the Pontine Marshes and the Tiber Delta was actually sort of a biological warfare, in which the mosquitoes then began to fly, and then the malaria that they transmitted was a significant barrier for the Allied troops moving northward.
Well, true, isn't it?
Yeah. Say again.
It's true, it looks like.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine trying to get your tanks or even walking across these marshy areas, but then confronting the mosquitoes that were buzzing ferociously by this time.
Exactly.
Meanwhile, the malariologists in Rome were using these areas as suddenly sort of this new episode of heightened malaria, which we showed in those graphs. And they said, well, why don't we try out DDT, which was new, except for it had been used in Naples. But then they said, why don't we try it out against mosquitoes instead of lice? And at this point, they actually had control sites which were left unsprayed, and then other areas which were sprayed quite heavily. And so they wanted to observe the effects on mosquito populations. And so lo and behold, the mosquito populations died dramatically in the sprayed areas, but in the areas that were not sprayed, malaria continued, people still caught malaria. And so one begins to say, well, if they knew that this DDT was going to be so powerful, and all signs suggested that it would be, then why were they withholding these insecticides in the areas that were still malaria? So that in some respect, the people who lived in these areas that were flooded, because there were farmers and there were peasants and people that were living in these areas, they didn't receive the sort of treatment that they might have. And so there's ethical questions of why weren't the strongest pesticides used and allowed and sprayed over these other areas as well.
Exactly. And what about the anti-malaria drugs?
And then same happens with the anti-malarials. And so this is a tradition in the 1930s whereby people are used, particularly prisoners of war and people in prisons are then used basically as human guinea pigs. They were induced with malaria, or maybe they had malaria themselves within these prisons, and so they were considered perfect places to try out the latest anti-malarial remedies, of which there were dozens, some of which they thought might be good, some of which they had no clue. But and so the very unethical practices of simply trying out these anti-malarials on these incarcerated people, or psychological institutes, psychotic
mental disabilities.
Patients. So part of this was this small episode that some of you may know about. It's called malaria therapy, and it was common in the 1930s as a treatment against syphilis. And the person who discovered this remedy himself won the Nobel Prize, so it was considered quite a miraculous cure to induce high fever with malaria for these syphilitic patients, who then would experience within a week or two a bit of relief from their syphilis and from their advanced stage of the syphilis neurological problems that many Europeans then suffered from this disease. So this world of malaria therapy led straight into trying out different drugs with different patients in the Pontine Marshes, and also in some of the institutions in Rome. In some cases, the German malariologists were working hand in hand with the Italian malariologists, both to devise new remedies, but also to manage and to sort of oversee this project of biological warfare of reflooding the Pontine Marshes for this summer of 1944.
It's really like a huge open air laboratory. If you think about the opportunity that they had, it's okay, but it was a little bit controversial if you're thinking from an ethical point of view. I mean, for sure we collected.
Yes, it was certainly ethically questionable, but I mean, this was a wartime and people were desperate and things were moving month by month. The next big story, of course, is this whole sort of experimental project along Rome then is moved to Sardinia after the war.
The Sardinia project.
Yeah, the famous
Sardinian project. If we want to know more about this, of course, I invite people to watch the Sardinian project movie that Mark mentioned, and to read more about this interesting study between the war effect on the malaria in the book chapter. Mark, it was really great to talk to you, and I enjoy the subject. I enjoy listening to you, so I hope people also had a very good time.
Maybe this will serve in some distant way to help combat the whole problems of mosquito-borne diseases, but I think looking at past records and archival sources are still useful. So good. Thanks for talking, Neva.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. And have a nice day. Thank you very much for your talk.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Mark. Bye.